Good morning. This is Katie Kiefer from The Main Course, and today is September 11th, 2011. It's the 10th anniversary of an event that I think can arguably said to have changed the world. This morning, as I was driving back from Rhode Island, I was listening to the New York City, the WNYC coverage of the events starting at 8 o'clock. And one of the things that struck me is that no one spoke to the fact that what makes New York so unique and so vital to the world and world culture is that we did not shred as a society. We stayed together, our center held. And I think that one of the things to be celebrated after 9/11, and certainly what makes me most proud to be a New Yorker then and now, is that in spite of the magnitude of this event, and in spite of, you know, some random incidents, of course, afterwards, we basically represent living proof that millions of people from all over this world, with sometimes radically different backgrounds or beliefs, can maintain a cooperative, compassionate, and harmonious society. And I think that what we need to show the rest of the world is that this is an example, it's a beacon, and it's proof that the bad guys will never, ever win, no matter what they do or who they are. We will always triumph because New Yorkers show that everyone can live together despite their differences. We'll be right back with The Main Course on September 11th, 2011.
You're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com, bringing you the freshest radio in Brooklyn since 2009. Hear directly from chefs to farmers, artists to architects, authors to brewers, and everyone in between. Check out all of our shows on our website or by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. On behalf of everybody at HeritageRadioNetwork.com, we'd like to send a special thank you to the Hearst Ranch, our biggest supporter and longest-running sponsor since we first started in 2009. Hearst Ranch is the nation's largest single-source supplier of free-range, all-natural, grass-fed, and grass-finished beef. Since 1865, the Hearst family has raised cattle on the rich, sustainable native grasslands of the Central California coast. The result is beef with extraordinary flavor that's as memorable and natural as the surrounding landscape. For more information, visit www.hearstranch.com.
Good morning. This is The Main Course. I'm your host, Katie Kiefer. My partner in crime, Patrick Martins, is taking a well-deserved break after holding down the fort for a month without me. We have a terrific show lined up today. Our first guest will be Jean Hodesh, who is the director of publicity for the Green Market and Grow New York, Grow NYC, which is one of the largest farmers markets organizations in the country. And following our segment with Jean, we'll be talking about hydrofracking in upstate New York. Our guests for that segment will be Ramsey Adams from the Catskill Mountain Keeper and Dennis Holbrook from the Independent Oil and Gas Association of New York. So we'll be getting a good sort of round view of the whole issue. But in the meantime, let's start off with Jean. Jean, are you there right now?
Yes, good morning.
Hi, how are you? It's great to hear your voice.
I'm well. How are
you? Sorry,
we're
not seeing you in the flesh, but I'll see you on Wednesday.
Sure.
So, Jean, let's talk quickly about what's going on. The reason I wanted to have the Green Market comment this week is in the wake of Irene and all of the incredible devastation that people saw in the news and in the newspapers of the upstate New York agricultural areas. I just wanted to get a sense of like what's happening at the Green Market and what you have seen personally as the sort of the biggest impact of the storm.
Sure. So there are lots of different layers that we've been seeing, and, you know, the floodwaters are still receding upstate, and they're also continuing to get a lot more rain. So I think the full extent of the damage still really isn't known to us and won't be for a few more weeks as the fields start to empty out and people can really start to see what the damage is out in those fields, what needs to be done to rebuild. But I can tell you that about, we have 235 family farm programs in the Green Market program.
Right.
And about 80% of them were affected in some way by the storm. Wow. So that could have been some minor flooding in a basement or a shed, or some of them, about 15 of our producers, 15 to 30 of our producers, suffered severe crop loss, between, you know, 80 and 100% crop loss. So that said, our markets were open at 5 a.m. following the storm. And for everyone who could get down to the city who had harvested before the storm or who weren't so poorly affected, those markets were full. And so there have been a lot of stories in the press that are saying, you know, the markets are taking a hit. But this is September. It's the biggest harvest month of the whole year, and the markets are open, and they're full of produce. Some people have less of it to offer now.
Well, that was one of the, I just wanted to jump in and say one of the things that really concerned me when I read that the FDA had banned the sale of any produce that was touched by floodwaters. So obviously some farmers are going to lose 100% of their crop. But what, I mean, in terms of like this being the peak point of the harvest, this has got to have like a major economic impact going forward for at least 30 of your producers, right?
Right. So, I mean, it's couldn't have happened at a worse time of year. So it's like in the spring, everybody is planting, they're fixing fences, they're going into debt because they're making lots of investments for the coming season. In the summer, they're paying off those debts, their workers. In the fall is really when they make the bulk of their money that's going to sustain the business through the winter months ahead and carry them into the next season, and hopefully make some profit too. So with a hard hit in September, people are definitely looking for all the customer support that they can get.
Absolutely.
But also, you know, we've got a farmer who has 28 acres just outside New Paltz. She lost 26 of them. They're underwater. She's still a Grand Army every weekend and has been filling what she's got. And I went by yesterday, and on the table that was no longer filled with produce like it would normally be, she had signs up sort of educating and informing all of her regular shoppers about what had been lost in those fields. And yet she still had some tomatoes that were saved from the two fields that weren't underwater, and people were buying them, and so she was able to make some money on the market day. So that's great. And then, you know, we've got another story of one of our farmers who his tomatoes weren't underwater, but because of all of the humidity in there, the tomatoes split, so he couldn't sell them, but he could sauce them because they weren't, you know, damaged in any way, except that they weren't, you know, going to look very nice on the table. So he was able to take them to Farm to Table, which is a co-packing facility upstate, and they're all getting turned into tomato sauce, which can then be sold as a product at the market. So people are thinking creatively, doing what they can, and while some of them have smaller stacks of carrots and onions, you know, it's about to be apple harvest season, and so, you know, maybe their apple trees weren't affected. So we really want people to know that the markets are open, and of the other farmers who weren't affected, there's still, you know, a lot available in the market right now.
Absolutely. I mean, New York State is not the only contributor to the farmers markets. We have farms from New Jersey, from Connecticut, right?
Mm-hmm.
So there is plenty of stuff out there. Does crop insurance generally protect farmers under these circumstances, do you think? Or is this going to be just a total write-off for a lot of these guys?
It's sort of like catastrophe insurance, as I understand it. And so it might cover some people. It depends on how much they lost. For other people, you know, there might just be, I know one of our farmers said that he just has $10,000 worth of damage to the farm, fences down, things that need repairs. That's just not going to be covered by any of the insurance that he's got. So right now it's really, really important for all of the farmers to document everything that's getting flooded and damaged and then report it to FSA and to the Cornell Cooperative Extension, so that all of those damages can be noted when and if federal, you know, assistance is, you know, available and applicable for their situation.
Well, that was my next question. Is upstate New York going, I mean, is the governor applying for federal disaster relief or something equivalent to that to give...
Yeah.
Raise some more funds for these guys?
Right. So luckily, we've got Governor Cuomo in office, and he's been terrifically supportive right from the beginning and getting eight counties in New York State declared states of disaster. So that then opens up some funding. Gillibrand has been also really great, and her office will have representatives at our next FCAC meeting, which is a once-a-month meeting that we have of community members and farmers in the program who come together. And the Cornell Cooperative Extension will also have representatives there, so we can start to have everybody in the same room and, you know, start to address, here are the problems and here are the funds that, you know, might be available and how can we work together.
Thing I did notice in the papers is that Cuomo has established a fund that I think at the beginning has, what is it, $15 million? But aren't they estimating more like $45 million and just that's just the beginning?
The numbers are pretty staggering. And again, yeah. You know, we're still assessing everything. A lot of people just don't know exactly what's happened out in their fields entirely, you know. So, and like, it keeps raining. It was raining all last week. So it's hard to, we don't have a final figure yet. It keeps rising.
Right. And I imagine it will be continuing to rise. Now, one of the things that I thought about was I had a friend who was driving over from Vermont or something like that, and a lot of mm-hmm. roads were destroyed. So mm-hmm. it's not just whether or not a field is flooded, but it's also the mm-hmm. fact that major infrastructure has been damaged. And what mm-hmm. do you think the estimates are on getting some of those roads back together, and how are farmers coping with that added burden of getting whatever product they have to market? Is the state offering any assistance in that level?
Well, I can't speak to when the state's going to fix the roads, unfortunately. But I can tell you that, I mean, when considering all of the losses, a number of farmers were out of power and without phone lines for, you know, a week or more. And for one of our fishmongers, that meant that their processing facility was shut down. So even if they could catch fish, they couldn't get them, you know, cleaned up and brought to market in time. So they missed market days. So those dollars add up really fast. If the road is washed out and you just can't get out of your county to drive down to the city and you lose market days. Or if you're, I think some people had, you know, storage facilities or like their cooling capabilities were flooded. And so then that's out because the power is off. So the expenses add up and the infrastructure is certainly, there's some big holes that are going to need to be repaired, and I think it's going to take a really long time.
Yeah, I mean, I think that when people think about farmers, you know, and they lose their crops, and you sort of, mm-hmm. your imagination kind of fails in terms of thinking about these other aspects, but like having a road be washed out or having power for a week or say, your barn is flooded and you have no place to house or you lose your livestock or say your tractor has been destroyed. I mean, that's the kind of, infrastructure investments that represent huge loans for farms and which, you know, are not so readily replaced, I think. And I think that when people think about the loss of farming or farmland, it kind of stops there. And then all these other aspects don't really get addressed so well. So that's one of the reasons why I wanted to be sure that you came on the show so that we could really, you know, unpack the whole magnitude of this disaster. And as you say, it's continuing to rain and it looks like it's going to rain right now in New York City. So it's probably already raining upstate. I can only imagine how these people are feeling about that.
But, you know, I have to say the other great thing about working through this particular situation with all of these farmers is that, I was talking to Albert Wilklow from Wilklow Orchards last weekend. He's a seventh-generation farmer, and they are primarily an apple orchard, but they lost all of their heirloom tomato crop, which is a significant portion of their business. And, you know, but he was smiling and he was laughing and he said, I don't want people to feel bad for me. You know, my grandpa looked out at that rain and he said, it's worse than the flood of 55. And that's crazy. But you know what? He was out taking pictures of it and they're just going to wait and the water's going to recede. And luckily they didn't lose their apple trees and they're going to repair and move on. And so there's this amazing sense of, optimism too, that this is farming.
And next year is another year.
Next year's another year. You get to it and you work through it.
Yeah, I know. That is a beautiful thing. And then is there a sense of cooperation amongst the farmers in the sense that that they are, you know, if your farm is not so, or your tractor or your truck got flooded, you know, is somebody coming by to pick up produce for you to take it down to the city or whatever? Are there groups of farms that work with the green market that are coming together in that way to help each other?
Yeah, I think that, like, Kerry Kinney and Ray Bradley are two of our farmers at Grand Army Plaza, and Ray also sells at our 97th Street Market. Their farms are right next to each other, and they were both hit really, really hard. And the other farmers who sell with them at those markets have been pulling together to organize fundraisers for them, I mean, helping to share their story as, you know, just an, you know, yet another mouthpiece who has, you know, another business that has yet another range of customers to be able to explain what's going on. So in terms of being able to share equipment, I haven't heard personal stories about that, although I'm sure when people live close to each other, I think everyone's pulling together and doing as much as they can to help each other through this. I know that I heard a story about Kira. I think she's a neighbor who raises horses. And during the storm, Kira got everything inside, and then her neighbor called and said, "You gotta come over and help me get these horses in." And the water was like up around the horses' necks. You know, it's like, definitely people are pulling together and helping each other out to do what they can, and taking some really big risks in doing that, I would say.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, when you guys, do you guys have sort of relief organizations that the Green Market is promoting, or do you have on your website numbers or organizations that people can look up so that if they wanted to make a donation or support upstate farming community, they can do that? Can you tell us about those a little
bit? Yes. So right away, we got up a page on our website. Our website is www.grownyc.org/relief is our relief page. So we have started a fund for raising funds that will be then distributed to the farmers in the program who have been hardest hit. So donations have been pouring in, and everybody, all of these committed shoppers are just chomping at the bit to figure out how it is they can help. And, you know, they want to volunteer, but actually right now I think that the best thing to do is to just keep shopping and to donate if you're able to. So that option is available loud and clear on our relief page. Then we've got resources for farmers on that page as well, so numbers for the Cooperative Extension, for FSA offices, and for the senators. And then we've also been working with, there's a group of food writers who wanted to do something, so they got together and have formed this campaign, Dine Out Irene, which is going to take place on September 25th. So a number of restaurants around the city have signed on. It's a Sunday, and they'll donate between 1% and 10% of their profits from the day to this farmer fund through Grow NYC. So you can go to their website, which is dineatirene.com, and pick a restaurant to go to and make a reservation and go and know that a percentage of the money that's raised will go back to the farmers. And then just following that for a week, Green Market is kicking off a campaign that will be Dine In Irene, so encouraging people to have potlucks or supper clubs in their homes, source everything from the market, and then either charge per plate or per seat if you want to do kind of a supper club type dinner, or if people are bringing dishes, ask them to bring donations as well. And then those funds can also be contributed to the Farmer Fund on our website. And then other people are planning benefits left, right, and center. As far as I can tell, there are more that I hear about every day. So there are, there's going to be Farm Aid in Warwick upstate, and Ray Bradley is having a farm party. He's also having a t-shirt contest. So all of this to raise funds for people who need it. So we've got a list just of events that we're updating about as quickly as we can as we find out about them. So that list is also on the website.
That's amazing, Jean. Thanks so much. Let's take like a 30-second break and then come right back and we'll talk a little bit about what's going on in the Green Market now, what kind of new programs you guys are doing. So stay tuned and we'll be right back with Jean Hodesh from Grow NYC.
Change, had to lay it down. Now I'm sitting in a church pew. The word stirs my soul in ways I never knew.
This is the main course on Heritage Radio Network. We're broadcasting live from the back of Roberta's in Bushwick. We're located at 261 Moore Street. Brunch is being served. My guest on the line today is Jean Hodesh. Jean is the Director of Publicity for Grow NYC and the Green Markets of New York City. Jean, thanks again for joining us today. So I just wanted to check in with you, having covered all of the fabulous events that are going on around trying to bolster up the agricultural community in New York. Let's talk a little bit about what's going on in the green markets in the coming season, since it's a brand new season for you guys. And I know you always have fantastic new programs every September. So tell us a little bit about what's going on.
Sure. So you want me to start with programs and then get into what's available at the market? So we've got our school tours. Our youth education program really kicks into high gear in September when all the kids come back to school. So if you're a teacher and you're thinking it'd be fun to bring your kids on a tour of the market, you can definitely look up our youth education page on the website, which is grownyc.org. So that's really fun. So over the course of the year, we'll see about 8,000 kids come through the market, and we have access to do programming in the north. There's that pavilion building in the north end of Union Square Park. We're doing youth ed programming out of that during the week right now, which is really great. So cooking demos for kids and then teaching them about where their food comes from around the region. So that's fun. And then we've got our Educated Eater panel discussion series. So we had, I'm calling it our fall semester series this year, since usually these discussions are spread out over the course of the year. This year we're doing them all in the fall. So we just had one a couple weeks ago at the Astor Center. The next one is coming up at the French Culinary Institute this Wednesday, and it's all about corn. So corn always gets such a bad rap for, you know, GMO and for high fructose corn syrup, but actually, we want to just take a minute to really appreciate the rich history of this crop and, you know, what it means in different cultures and all the different ways that it's employed in, you know, polenta or in tortillas or distilled to make corn whiskey.
Pancakes.
Corn pancakes, exactly.
Oh,
think of the possibilities.
I eat corn every single day during the month of August. I just want you to know.
Do you?
It's
you just
a rule.
Eat it off the cob?
I literally have
a rule.
Yes, I must eat a fresh ear of corn every single day.
That's
and I just
awesome.
Came back from Rhode Island this morning. I brought two ears with me.
Oh, nice. So you're never without it. I love
I
that.
I try not to be.
So you're going to be there on Wednesday, so you'll really appreciate this. So
absolutely.
We're going to have Ian Cheney, who was one of the co-creators of King Corn, will moderate. Mm-hmm. And then we're having Robin Berger from Hot Bread Kitchen speaking about how they've used corn at their bakery. And then we'll have Gable from Tuttletown Distillers talking about distilling corn to make whiskey. And we'll have Tor Oshner, who is with Cayuga Pure Organics upstate, talking about the types of corn that they grow, and they're actually now selling to Hot Bread Kitchen so that the corn in those tortillas is local corn. So anyway, it'll be
very cool.
Great discussion. And then afterwards, the French culinary students will be serving corn chowder, and we'll have some corn salsa, and we'll have some whiskey to drink also. So
thank God for that.
Thank God for that. We could all use a drink.
Why isn't anybody doing heirloom corn? That's another discussion, but that would be something worth talking about, actually, because I find that that current corn varieties, especially Silver Queen, which used to be my favorite, is overly sweet now, and the kernels are too big, and everything has kind of been hybridized to the point of losing its individuality, and there used to be many, many different strains of human, corn grown for human consumption. Not a lot of the products that you're talking about are what do they call it? They're sort of hard shell corn, or in the sense that you end up using it for something else. But those heirloom varieties of corn, I think she should be brought back just as tomatoes have been. So, but that, we'll talk about that another time. Maybe I can bring that up at the corn seminar at the French Culinary.
I think you should bring it up.
I'm definitely going to.
Tell Sorg you should plant some.
Yeah, absolutely.
So then in October we have got, well, I mentioned all of our hurricane benefits seem to be falling right around the last week of September. So those will take place. Then in October, we are going to be working. The Glenwood Center is developing a whole week around hard cider in the region, and so they're partnering with lots of different restaurants and slow food and just food and New Amsterdam Market, all kinds of different food outlets in the city. Green Market's participating in that also. So we will have Eve Cidery is our one hard cider producer in the market right now. So we'll be doing cooking demonstrations beside their tent, talking about both how to cook with hard cider, but then also what it pairs well with. So that should be fun. And then in early November, we're working with Jimmy Carboni and the Food Karma Projects on Meat Week. Last year we did Grains Week, but this year Jimmy really wanted to do Meat Week. So I said, we'll do that with you. And we'll have a panel discussion about sustainable meat. We're going to have a butcher demo one night, and there's going to be a burger bash. So more info about that will be up on our website soon as well. So lots and lots to look forward to.
You guys really keep busy.
We keep busy. Man, yeah. I tell you what, besides just what you can buy in the market to eat yourself at home.
Yeah.
So that's what you want to talk about next, what's in season?
Yeah, let's just, because we only have a few minutes left, and then unfortunately we'll have to wrap it up. But you're going to come back, because Jean, you're just an awesome, awesome spokesperson for this.
Well, thank you.
I always knew you would be way back when it was local gourmands, when I first met you.
Way back when.
Yeah.
Yeah, now I get to tell everyone.
Yeah.
So right now it's grape season, which pleases me to no end. It's really exciting. So, and the grapes, within grape season, you'll get different grapes, like, each week. Like, people will have Concords for all of grape season, mm-hmm. but there were these amazing little, like, champagne grapes that were red seedless, and I got them the first day I saw them at the City Hall Market, which is conveniently right outside our offices on Chambers Street, and I picked them up, and I brought them upstairs to the office to validate them in, like, 5 minutes, and unfortunately, the farmer said, well, I'm just going to have them this week, so it's lucky you're getting them now. So eat your grapes while you can is my advice.
And they have white and purple Concord grapes now, which is really nice.
Yes, yes. And you can get amazing grape juice also for anyone mm-hmm. who wants to devour grapes but not spit the seeds out. So there's that. Cauliflower has started to show up.
Nice.
Winter squashes are coming in. What else? Oh, and
Swiss
apples,
chard?
Of course.
Yeah, apples.
Swiss
right.
chard, yeah. Swiss chard's around. Apples are coming in. So, and they look kind of, the first apples always look kind of new. Their color isn't quite as vibrant as it will be in a couple weeks, but the first Honeycrisps are coming in, and they're small and sweet and crisp and totally delicious. So, but, you know, the great thing about September is that you also still have watermelon all over the market. You still have bushels and bushels of corn. Peaches are just kind of on their way out, but they're still there. If you want to can tomatoes, there are tomatoes all over the place. You know, summer squash is still all over the place also. So September is really, this is the month we look forward to for eating. There is just a lot available at the market to work with.
Absolutely. That sounds great. Well, I hope that everybody has been writing down all of these fantastic, at least the events, which sound amazing. But remember that all of this stuff is listed on the grownyc.org webpage. Jean Hodesh, mm-hmm. Director of Publicity for Green Market and for Grow NYC. Thank you so, so much for joining us today. This has been terrific. You're a wonderful spokesman for the farmers and for the markets. And I look forward to doing this with you on a regular basis. I thought this was just a terrific segment. I know that everybody is interested in hearing what's going on both upstate and in the city with the Green Market program. So we will stay tuned. Thank you so much, darling.
Great.
Take
Thanks,
care,
Katie.
Jean. Have a good afternoon.
Bye-bye. I can see shadow running right ahead of me, and I reach out my hand. Still an echo in my head, and I reach out again.
This is the main course on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Katie Kiefer. My partner, Patrick Martins, is taking a well-deserved break this week. We are going to be talking about hydrofracking in upstate New York. This is an all-New York segment today. And on the line with me right now, I have Ramsey Adams, who is the executive director of the Catskill Mountain Keeper Organization, which is an environmental nonprofit group which has been devoted to sustainable economic growth and the promotion of natural resources in the state. And you guys have been lobbying against hydrofracking for several years, at least. I know I had deputy director Wes Gillingham on a couple of years ago to talk about this, and now the controversy has heated up much more as we move into a more sort of substantive policy debate around hydrofracking with the governor's office involved and so on. I wanted to just, before I bring you in, Ramsey, into the discussion, I wanted to just read something that I put together about hydrofracking, because I think that people are not so aware of where information is and where they can get it. But on September 7th, the New York Times reported that the Department of Environmental Conservation had released a full draft of their report on hydrofracking in the Marcellus Shale deposits in New York State. And to read that report, listeners can go to either the New York Times for that day, September 7th, or they can go directly to the DEC website, which is www.dec.ny.gov. And I also want to note that I offered a spot on the show to the DEC. Their spokesperson, Emily DeSantis, who had been interviewed by the Times, declined to comment, did not want to either bring somebody else from DEC or be a participant herself in the program, and was totally okay with me making that announcement. I just wanted to let people know that the Department of Environmental Conservation, after publishing this report, has chosen to take on the mantle of silence about the report and its findings. And I also want to announce that there will be a series of four public hearings on this report and on the regulations that it proposes during the month of November. The dates and the locations of those hearings will be announced in October. So people who are concerned about hydrofracking in New York State should stay tuned. Keep an eye on that DEC website, and all of that information will be made available to you. So just to start off with you then, Ramsey, I'm hoping to have another guest join us. At the moment, he's not available, but once he is, he'll be able to jump right in. But I wanted to talk to you because you guys have been so vocal about how bad hydrofracking is going to be for the state. What do you identify as the major sources of concern for fracking, and particularly in light of the fact that so much of New York State and upstate New York is economically depressed and could really use the financial boost that fracking is supposedly going to offer?
Katie, thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it. I love your show. Food
Thank
is
you.
the new black, as somebody said, and it's really it's exciting. I see upstate New York, the Catskills, the Schoharie Valley, and the Southern Tier is the food shed for New York City.
Absolutely.
And as most of your listeners know, and they definitely should know if they don't, we are the watershed for New York. All of that wonderful, unfiltered, fresh, fabulous drinking water that comes out of the tap comes from the reservoirs in the Catskills. And we are literally an abundant resource of water. It's an incredible river, streams, lakes, the Delaware River, the Hudson River, and the Schoharie River. And you can't talk about fracking now without talking about flooding. And frankly, one of the hardest realities that have hit us up here is that fracking and flooding don't mix. And what are the concerns that people who live here, who see this industry wanting to come and industrialize the entire landscape to frack for deep shale gas, what are the concerns we have? Well, there's a long list. But if you just say, okay, well, let's just talk about water and the amount of water it takes to frack a gas well, millions of gallons of water they're going to take from these aquifers that feed 19 million people. You're going to take this water, pollute it with chemicals, shoot it, inject it into the ground, try to treat some of it, have holding ponds and infrastructure. And, okay, all that's fine and good, assuming you never, ever have an accident, which is ridiculous. But flooding is not something that you can predict against, and there's not something that you can build against in this industry. So you just can't look at this right now and say, what are we thinking? I mean, the risk for profits for Exxon at this, when really what is most important for New York City and for Pennsylvania, Philadelphia, Camden, Trenton, and the people who live here is fresh, clean water.
Ramsey, we are now joined on the line with our other guest, who is, Dennis Holbrook. Dennis, welcome. Mr. Holbrook, I'll just briefly introduce you, and then you can, if you want to, you know, comment on anything that Dennis has just said about the water supply in New York and the potential for damage. And I have a really, in a way, I'm thinking Hurricane Irene is kind of a watershed moment, if you will, in this whole debate. But Mr. Holbrook is the Executive Vice President of Regulatory and Public Relations for Norse Energy Company, and he is also on the board for the Independent Oil and Gas Association of New York, which is, you know, an important body that is helping to assign leases and so forth. Mr. Holbrook has over 35 years of experience in the energy industry and is focused most of his work on the legal, public policy, contractual, and especially regulatory matters pertaining to energy and energy issues, certainly in the New York State area. So welcome to you, Mr. Holbrook. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me.
Were you able to hear what Ramsey was saying about the importance of the Catskill Mountain region as the watershed and water supply for New York and so many, related areas here?
I was not able to hear it. I'm actually en route right now, so I'm at an airport. So,
oh yeah, can
I
hear
was
some...
going through security, I think, when he was speaking. But
oh, too bad. Okay.
But yeah, I don't question as a starting point. The importance of fresh water and clean water, whether it's in the Catskill region or whether it's in any other part of the state.
Well,
so I think that's a given.
Yeah, of course. But I think that the point that that Ramsey was making is that that hydrofracking, while it's certainly not a new technology, the pits for flowback water, which is the water that has been used to fracture the shale and then comes back up to the surface and is typically stored in pits or bins, there's no as to date, according to Ramsey, there is no technology that exists that will guard against flooding, as we have just seen, for instance, the kind of massive flooding that we've seen with, in the wake of Hurricane Irene. And I just wondered how the industry is addressing the concerns that must have surfaced around that, as you move forward in debating the issues around this policy.
I think, first of all, it's worth noting that the SGIS, that the DEC is in the process of promulgating, anticipates using storage tanks, so you're not dealing with open pits, so therefore you wouldn't be dealing with any flooding of those pits because you'd be dealing with closed containers.
Right. Interesting. I did not see that on the DEC report, which I read with some interest, but
yeah.
I'm sure it's in there somewhere.
There. It's understandable given the breadth of it.
Yes, it's pretty big.
You may not catch everything. Yes.
Absolutely. Dennis, let me ask you this question, and then if Ramsey would like to respond, that would be great. How much money is hydrofracking going to be generating for the state in, say, tax revenues alone, just for instance?
Well, you realize, it's sort of like some of the extrapolations that are being done right now on the federal side in terms of budgets. You don't ever really have the full evidence, of course, until you have the opportunity to produce, but you can look just across the state in neighboring Pennsylvania and extrapolate from that. Pennsylvania is going to be a more expansive drilling program than New York is ever anticipated to be just because of the breadth of the shale formations down there in terms of the areas of the state that it covers. But even with that said, I pointed out to people, my company that's been drilling, traditional wells that we think has a small fraction of the advantage that the shales do. My company, which is a small to mid-sized company, we did a little press conference about a year ago where we printed up golf tournament size checks to reflect what we had paid in the one small rural county of Shenango in New York State to the school district, the town, and the county in 1 year. And those checks totaled $750,000. That was our direct contribution as a taxpayer as a result of taxes on our activities in that one rural county in 1 year. So what I pointed out at the time to those that were assembled is our expectation is that if we have the opportunity to properly develop the shale, you could be talking about tens of millions of dollars of annual contribution. And a big part of that is because, and a lot of people aren't aware of this, we have a tax on production in New York State. A significant portion of what we produce goes to either royalties to the property owners or directly to the communities in which we're operating in the form of production taxes. So it's not surprising that you're going to be able to make a substantial economic contribution. That's just directly. And then, of course, you have sales tax, income tax for all the people that you employ, both directly and then indirectly through all the services that you contract for. And it's worth noting, too, that most of those services we end up using local parties. We hire local contractors who pave the roads and prepare the drilling sites. We hire local hydrologists to test for water quality before we ever go in to consider drilling. And just on down the list, then you get all the restaurants and the hotels and everything else that get all the ancillary benefits as well. So there is a pretty significant ripple effect. In terms of giving you a macro, I've seen projections right now that some of the academic institutions have done, Penn State and others, Manhattan Institute, that are talking about economic impact to New York State in the billions of dollars. So it's a pretty significant potential economic stimulus to a region, particularly upstate, that is desperately in need of that kind of economic stimulation.
They certainly are.
And contribution.
Well, one of the things that, I mean, I've done a little reading up about natural gas and natural gas wells, and they don't last very long. You know, typically a well is exhausted in anywhere from 1 to 4 or 5 years. So what you're saying is that in the next 1 to 5 years, if these, you know, if hydrofracking becomes a bigger industry in upstate New York, that for 1 to 5 years, those deposits will yield that kind of benefit. But then what happens after that? Those jobs are going to go away. You know, the services that have been built up are then going to languish, don't you think? Or do you anticipate that these shale deposits are going to be yielding natural gas over decades as opposed to over just a few years?
Well, let me see if I can help you. We've been operating in western New York going back 25 years. Uh-huh. Most of the wells that we drilled over in that region are still producing. We came into central New York about 15 years ago. The well that got our interest in central New York in Shenango County was a well that was drilled in 1960. Mm-hmm. That well is still producing today. So I guess if I don't accept the initial premise, I've heard that said out there, and I find it somewhat comical. Here's what people don't understand, and if you're not dealing with the industry, it's an understandable misconception. We get a significant portion of the life of the well in the early years. You might get 50 to 60 to 70% in the first year to 2 years, and I think what people assume is, oh, well, then that means probably, just as you said, in 3 or 4 years, that well's probably gone, right? No. What happens is these wells tend to get very flat and then tend to produce for many, many years to come at a reduced level. So you don't deplete them in the four-year time frame that you were projecting. You do get a significant amount of initial flush production. But after that, they tend to, we refer to them as the tail.
Yeah.
Basically, it's the life of the well. And as I said, not every well is going to be producing from 1960, like our marker well that got us into central New York. But we fully expect, from everything we've examined, to see a long life to these wells. So, no, I don't expect to be, just as we haven't been before, we don't expect to be in for a few years and then gone, and then you're dealing with the consequence.
Okay.
You know, we're spending tens of millions of dollars right now on infrastructure, building pipelines and whatnot to ultimately move the gas. And as I've often told people, if you look back at the history of the industry, western New York, western Pennsylvania, what are today, you know, natural gas utility companies started out as the gathering systems for production wells. So even after you're producing, whatever time period that may be, a lot of these facilities and the rights of way that have been created are going to lend themselves to bringing natural gas service areas of the state that historically have not had natural gas service.
Mm-hmm. Okay, good answer. Ramsey, do you want to comment on that? Because I think that does speak directly to the concerns that you have about the potential for disaster in terms of, say, a well blowout or some, disaster with flowback, pollution of groundwater and whatnot. So if it's going to be a long-term thing that brings an economic boost to the region, do you think that is going to offset or mitigate some of the potentially environmental disaster problems that you predict?
Sure. Well, I think I got three direct, responses to Mr. Holbrook's statements. One is that at this point, the Securities and Exchange Commission is probing whether gas companies are exaggerating their reserves and have adequately disclosed the risks to investors from drilling. And the New York Attorney General, Eric Schneiderman, is also requesting similar information from the companies. The New York Times has done a comprehensive four-piece investigative story on the natural gas companies and questioned whether or not even this is a Ponzi scheme. I'm not saying that's what I think. I'm saying that's what the New York Times has put out. So other than the anecdote about blown up checks being handed out to people in Chenango County, the economic statements that come from the gas companies at this point have to be really looked at with a lot of suspicion. For example, the New York State Draft Supplemental Environmental Impact Statement hired a company from Lancaster, New York, called Ecology and Environment, to do the socioeconomic analysis of fracking. This is a company that's deeply entrenched in the gas industry and has done tons of work for them. And basically, again, the New York Times looked at this study that's part of the EIS and just said it cannot be considered a valid economic analysis because of their ties to the industry. In Pennsylvania, Penn State, which Mr. Holbrook mentioned, has been hired by the industry to put out reports. And two of the reports that came out, they didn't disclose where their funding came from. The third report that came out, it was disclosed that it was the Marcellus Shale Coalition that was paying for it, and the study overestimated every piece of the jobs and the amount of money it was going to earn. In fact, it's the report that the industry paid for says that 140,000 jobs are supported by the industry, but the Department of Labor and Industry in Pennsylvania said it was less than 19,000. Who knows? But the fact is that at this point there is no sort of confidence that any of the numbers, any of the sort of theories about how big billions of dollars and all that is something that anybody can bet the bank on. And frankly, Cornell and others have started to do economic analysis and say gas drilling is actually negative for a county that has gas drilling as opposed to a positive. So even if they get $750,000 in revenue from an energy company, the amount of it costs for the county to deal with the infrastructure, the roads, and the rest. So it's just a lot of questions, and I just urge all of the listeners to really question where the information's coming from, and hold out at this point from making the assumption that it's really about jobs versus the environment, because to a lot of people, including myself, it's a much more complicated bargain.
I think that Mr. Holbrook is feeling that he's been cut off of the interview. Mr. Holbrook, are you still there?
Yeah, but I was having difficulty hearing your other participant. He faded for a while there. I almost hung up, but I think I got the gist of it.
I would like it if you would, because what he's saying, essentially, just to recap for you, is that some of the studies that you point to are studies that have been funded by the gas and oil industries, and so and should be looked at with perhaps some skepticism, as Cornell University is beginning to do, and some of the other media outlets. So please do respond to that.
Well, what I would suggest to him is he ought to look to the source of some of the things he was quoting. The New York Times chose to find one dissident out in the industry and pretended by using anonymous sources that they couldn't disclose that it reflected a broader base, which it clearly didn't. I would suggest to them that if you want to start casting dispersions on these studies that have been done by Duke University, MIT, Manhattan Institute, Penn State University, just to name four, that I would suggest he ought to take a look and see where the money is coming from that is funding a few of the professors at Cornell that are sort of the champions of the anti-movement. So, yeah, we can follow the money. I think it'd be a very relevant point to do so, and I'd be happy to have a discussion at any point in time when he has a chance to actually see the money trail.
Well, I think
the
we
bottom
should...
line is you don't have to take my word for it.
Right.
You don't have to take the word of the academics. Look at the U.S. Geological Survey that just came out and increased by 4,000%. Its estimate now of the reserve capabilities that are being pursued in the shales. Mm-hmm. This is the government coming in. The Energy Information Agency did the same thing and came up with even a larger figure. So your government agencies right now, and yes, there are entities out there that have been asked to do studies because a lot of the misinformation in the public arena, some of it sponsored by the New York Times. And so, yes, you have different agencies out there that are saying, we're going to take a look. Whether it's the New York State Attorney General, whether it's the EPA, I welcome those looks because at the end of the day, if we allow science to actually address this, rather than a lot of hype, or rather than a lot of people going out and thinking that they're going to get their scientific information from a movie like Gasland, if they actually get the science, then I think people will be reassured. This industry, you know, I point out to people, it isn't by accident that when the Chilean miners were looking to be rescued a year ago, And anybody in the world would volunteer to help out. And where did they turn? They turned to the U.S., to the oil and gas industry in the U.S., and our technology, which ultimately was utilized to go down and rescue those miners. We should not ever underestimate the quality and the expertise that we have right here in our backyard.
There's an awful lot of
questionings out there. Some of it I understand, and it's legitimate.
Yes.
And we're going to do all we can in the industry to address it. But there's a lot of misinformation floating around out there.
Exactly why I've invited both of you to come on the show, and I hope that you will both return, because we only have about 5 minutes left, and I'm not even close to being done with all of my questions. I think that, Mr. Holbrook, with all due respect, given that the oil and gas industry is also responsible for the British Petroleum blowout in the Gulf of Mexico only a year ago, that there is, you know, some skepticism about the, shall we say, the incontrovertible excellence of our technology there. But anyway, let's move on from that because there are much more important things to debate here. And with just a few minutes to go,
if you want to talk about offshore oil, which is what in deep waters. That's an entirely different issue.
Well, I think we're talking about producing natural gas domestically. Forgive me, but even in the DEC report, they do talk. One of the pages that interested me the most was the chapter that was titled A Summary of Potential Impacts and Proposed Mitigation Measures. And of course, one of, you know, in many, many instances within that chapter, they do discuss well blowouts and, you know, and disasters of that type, which is essentially, although it may be not in deep water, it's still in deep dirt and deep rock. And so, obviously carries some measure of similar risk in the sense of polluting.
Well, there's nothing we do. I'm getting ready to get on an airplane.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing we do in life that doesn't come with some measure of risk.
Indeed, sir.
I think what we have to do is look at rational decision-making on this. I think the DEC is a very good example, and I'm glad you brought it up. The SGIS, all this hype about hydrofracking and all this worry about whether it can be done safely, all the research that's been done by the DEC for the last 3+ years, in that lengthy document, you won't find anywhere in there where they're going to say that there's any issue about the technology of hydrofracking ultimately contaminating drinking water. There's no suggestion whatsoever in that study, the Duke study, any of the other studies that have been done out there. And the Duke study started out to try and prove that there was a problem.
Uh-huh.
So the gentleman's suggestion that somehow it's who supports the initial study is really misapplied there. Bottom line is, there are things that can happen on the surface, but they're relatively minor compared to talking about what could happen if you truly had an issue of contamination in the subsurface. Mm-hmm. So let's go back up to the surface. Yes, you can have well blowouts. That's why you have well blowout preventers. That's why you have technology designed to deal with it. The bottom line is it's relatively minor. If you were going to start taking the position that a well can't blow out and therefore we'll never have an oil and gas industry, then applying that same standard, we shouldn't drive cars, we shouldn't be in airplanes, because things don't always go perfect.
But the point
is, it's relatively minor, and you can address it in much lesser terms than what you were talking about dealing with an oil issue in deep water like BP. That's the whole point there.
Okay. Well, then let's, since we're not really talking about deep water drilling, let's go back to what's happening in Pennsylvania and in what you guys would like to see happen in upstate New York. And you know, I'm clearly interested in getting both sides of the story out here. I do have one hard question for you left, since you brought up.
Can I answer just one thing?
Oh,
there?
Absolutely. Go ahead.
Yeah, the Duke study, which was looking at methane contamination of drinking water wells, and it was done by the professor of geochemistry and water quality. They found that it was scientifically corroborated in New York and Pennsylvania by the Duke researchers that methane from the drilling was contaminating drinking water wells, period. That was the finding. So I'm not exactly sure what Mr. Holbrook is saying other than the Duke.
You'll have to repeat for me what he's saying because I can't quite
okay.
hear him.
Look at Ramsey, one second. Let me repeat for Mr. Holbrook what you just said, which is that Duke study, their professor of geology and water quality, I've forgotten his title, conclusively determined that residential wells were indeed contaminated with methane, and that is supported by stories in the media, not just the New York Times, but other media outlets, of incidents, in Pennsylvania where residential groundwater had been severely compromised by hydrofracking. So, how do you respond to these stories?
I'd be happy to address that. First of all, he misquotes the study. The study set out to prove that hydraulic fracturing fluids were migrating and would ultimately contaminate drinking water, and the study proved the exact opposite. What the study then went on to do is it commented on the fact that it noticed that there seemed to be a higher amount of methane in drinking water wells in areas that were closer to drilling activity. Well, this isn't a great surprise. The areas where you choose to drill are going to have naturally occurring methane to begin with. What the study did not do, and what they said they would have to go back in and try and do, is actually establish a baseline so they had an idea of what the water wells looked like before the oil and gas industry came in there, which is what we do every time before we go out to drill.
Right.
And this is very relevant because throughout upstate New York and much of upper Pennsylvania, people know that when they go out and they drill water wells, whether there's an oil and gas industry anywhere near or not, they can encounter shallow methane deposits.
What about chemicals like benzene?
People will actually put a vent on a water well because they know that they're going to encounter shallow methane deposits, which has nothing
to do with oil and gas exploration. These are thermogenic. These are the deep shells
that they
found. The isotopes are from the
deep well.
This,
again, a case of misapplied, limited information that needs to be fully vented so that the listener gets a full appreciation for what we're talking about, not little snippets and bits and pieces.
It absolutely, without a doubt, states that this is deep water methane from deep shales. It's the same isotopes. It's a fingerprint, and this is what's polluting drinking water wells at the surface. So, you know, whether you agree or disagree with the Duke study is very clear. I mean, if you're calling into question the study itself, that's one thing, but to pretend like the study doesn't say what it says is quite another thing.
Gentlemen, I'm going to have to...
I have no problem with the Duke study, as long as you understand what the Duke study actually says. There's apparently a misunderstanding here, and it sounds like we aren't going to have enough time today.
Alas, we are not.
But I'd be happy to come back another point in time.
I'm counting on it. I will, you know, call you both after the show and we'll schedule another and lengthier debate on this issue. You've both been wonderful spokespeople. We barely got through a fraction of the questions that I had, which only means that I can do more and better preparation for our next encounter. So, Mr. Holbrook, I know you're traveling. I thank you so, so much for being part of the interview today. Ramsey, you and I will be talking. We'll bring you both back to do more about this. This is an area of vital interest and importance to the New York State economy and upstate New York agriculture and, just environmental sustainability. So once again, thank you to Dennis Holbrook from the Oil and Gas, Independent Oil and Gas Association of the New York State, and to Ramsey Adams from the Catskill Mountain Keeper organization. If you want to learn more about their organization, please check them out on CatskillMountainKeeper.org. Mr. Holbrook can be, more information about the Independent Oil and Gas Association can be seen on their website as well. And you can also, I urge listeners, all of you, to take a look at the DEC report. This is, as I say, a matter of vital concern to all of our residents here. So thank you very much again for participating, and we'll be in touch. And this has been the September 11th issue of The Main Course. I'm your host, Katie Kiefer. Many thanks to our sponsors, and we'll see you next week with Temple Grandin. Bye-bye.
This is a message from Fork and Anchor. Aaron Fitzpatrick, the host of our wine program, Unfiltered, is looking for help on Kickstarter to open Fork and Anchor, a general store inspired by two food-loving ladies with an equal affection for urban life, the sea, and the agricultural paradise of Long Island's North Fork. The store is situated in a growing community of farmers and winemakers and will become a meeting place offering prepared foods, a variety of sun-dries, and a selection of homespun products, many of which will have their origins in New York State. Your backing will help them fulfill their dream of fostering relationships with the community and making the local food system accessible on a broader scale. Search Kickstarter.com for Fork and Anchor and donate today.
Every spring at the end of kidding season, goat dairies across the country are faced with the question of what to do with their male bucklings. Because on a dairy farm, there's no role for a male. Often the most economical thing for these farmers to do is to cull the animals at birth or ship them off to the commodity market. Heritage Foods USA is embarking on a new project, No Goat Left Behind, looking to step in and fill this niche by creating a marketplace for these male bucklings. Visit us at www.heritagefoodsusa.com to learn more and to reserve your goat this coming October.